Welcome back to EVR 2858. We're now looking at part two of the Clean Water Act. By the end of this lecture, you should be able to describe what a non-point source is under the Clean Water Act, what the five conventional pollutants are, what a primary pollutant is, what the five non-conventional pollutants are, the types of permits issued under the NPDES program, the five components of a NPDES permit, the steps, timing, things needed for notice to polluter administrator to take to file a lawsuit under the Clean Water Act, and who administers the Clean Water Act Section 404 Dredge and Fill Permitting Program. We have looked at the history of the Clean Water Act and that Congress originally wanted to stop all dumping into the navigable waters of the United States by 1985. Nope, that didn't happen. We also looked at how Congress focused on point sources, or the end of the pipe where you could readily see pollution being spilled into water bodies. After having point sources filtered and massively reduced, Congress discovered that there wasn't enough reduction in the pollution levels for their liking. So they went back into the law and decided it was time to deal with non-point sources. Section 319 requires each state to prepare a report which, A1A, identifies those navigable waters within the state which, without additional action to control non-point sources of pollution, cannot reasonably be expected to attain or maintain applicable water quality standards or the goals and requirements of this act. Translation, identify impaired water bodies. A1B identifies those categories and subcategories of non-point sources, or where appropriate, particular non-point sources, which add significant pollution to each portion of the navigable waters identified under subparagraph A, in amount which contribute to such portion not meeting such water quality standards or such goals and requirements. Translation, identify types and sorts of pollutants for the above identified impaired water bodies. This section also requires each state to create a management program. Subsection B2 states the specific contents of those management program proposals. Please note, this is in English as opposed to all the statutory language. Pay attention to how this is a stepwise process. So first is identify water bodies being impaired by non-point sources. Where are their problems? That point source permits haven't worked enough, or the chemicals in question aren't coming from point sources. Identify types and sources of non-point pollution. Identify best management practices, BMPs. Identify how to implement best management practices. So come up with ideas to promote the management program through regulations, education, financial assistance, etc. A combination of carrots and sticks. So an example is the Everglades Agricultural Area has a BMP program. Identify a timetable for meeting goals of the BMP program. When are certain things supposed to happen, such as training all government, municipality, and private enterprise ventures involved of the BMPs available and how to coordinate their efforts? Document legal authority to impose management program or identify how to get there. So you need to have a certification by the state's lawyers that the current laws are adequate to impose sanctions on non-conformers, or if the laws aren't adequate, that the state will expeditiously pass laws that will help it attain the goals it is setting forth in the management proposal. Identify funding, federal, state, other, overall. So identify potential monetary assistance mechanisms for individuals. Where are you going to get the money? How much will come from the federal government, private grants, state revenue? Also, how is that money going to be allocated? What are you going to spend it on? For instance, placing monitoring sensors along every mile of a contaminated waterway and taking readings from those sensors once a week in order to come up with a picture of approximately where there is an influx of pollution, as well as to see if varying practices are reducing the pollutants in question. The CWA also tells the state to look for other possible financial assistance programs that it can apply for in order to assure that the management program will not fail just for lack of financial resources. For instance, in Florida, there is a Water Pollution Control Financial Assistance Program in Section 403.1835. And the Florida Water Pollution Control Financing Corporation in Section 403.1837. So let's take a look at the Florida Water Pollution Control Financial Assistance Program, which is in 403-1835. This statute states, the purpose of this section is to assist in implementing the legislative declaration of public policy as contained in section 403.021 by establishing a self-perpetuating program to accelerate the implementation of water pollution control projects. Projects and activities that may be funded are those eligible under section 603 of the Federal Water Pollution Control Act, public law number 92-500 as amended, including but not limited to planning, design, construction, and implementation of wastewater management systems, stormwater management systems, non-point source pollution management systems, and estuary conservation and management. Section 403.1837 establishes the Water Pollution Control Financing Corporation, which controls the Water Pollution Control Financial Assistance Program. So I mentioned in opening NPDES. This is an abbreviation for National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System. Section 402A1 of the Clean Water Act says, except as provided in Section 318 and 404 of this act, the administrator may, it's not mandatory, after opportunity for public hearing, issue a permit for the discharge of any pollutant or combination of pollutants, notwithstanding Section 301A, upon condition that such discharge will meet either A, all applicable requirements under Sections 301, 302, 306, 307, 308, and 403 of this Act, or B, prior to the taking of necessary implementing actions relating to all such requirements, such conditions as the administrator determines are necessary to carry out the provisions of this Act. So, once again, the permit may be issued. It is not a requirement that any permit applied for shall be issued, and it is left to the discretion of the EPA administrator. Also note that this says before a permit can be issued, there has to be a public hearing. The public in the area where the discharges are to occur must have the opportunity to hear what will be put into their local waters. This doesn't say public comment. You may wonder why this is important. For any federal regulation to be implemented, there is a public comment period. Usually, a proposed regulation is published in the Federal Register. Then anyone who wants can submit comments on the proposed regulation, usually 60 to 90 days from the date of publication. Once the comment period is over, the agency must review all comments and either incorporate them into the proposed regulation or state why particular comments were rejected when republishing the regulation for either another comment period or for final publication as a final rule. With a public hearing, all the agency has to do is set a date, time, and place to publicly review the permit application. The public can be there and comment, but the comments will usually be included in the administrative record but can be ignored right then and there. There does not need to be a formal reply per se. So this means that any point source can obtain a permit to dump any kind of pollutant, notwithstanding the Clean Water Act. So can a NPDES permit be weakened over time? Section 402O has an anti-backsliding. It is a general prohibition in the case of effluent limitations established on the basis of subsection A1B of this section. A permit may not be renewed, reissued, or modified on the basis of effluent guidelines promulgated under section 304B subsequent to the original issuance of such permit to contain effluent limitations which are less stringent than the comparable effluent limitations in the previous permit. In the case of effluent limitations established on the basis of Section 301B1C or Section 303D or E, a permit may not be renewed, reissued, or modified to contain effluent limitations which are less stringent than the comparable effluent limitations in the previous permit, except in compliance with Section 303D4. So these are permits for point source discharges. Section 402 specifically provides that once a permit is issued, a renewal of the permit cannot contain lesser effluent limitations than the original permit, unless the general effluent limitations applicable to that class of sources has been lessened. Remember the loophole discussions. There can be a way to get around this. So what are these loopholes? Some of them are called moderating provisions and can include changes in timetables for compliance, different compliance rules for initial operations versus regular operations, establishing linkages to other projects that have to be done or in compliance in order for compliance to be enforced. So NPDES regulations, here's where we get into the CFR or Code of Federal Regulations. So 40 CFR Section 122.1, Purpose and Scope, the coverage is the regulatory provisions contained in this part and parts 123 and 124 of this chapter implement the National Pollution Discharge Elimination System, NPDES, program under sections 318, 402, 405. In subsection 5, it states, certain requirements set forth in parts 122 and 124 of this chapter are made applicable to approved state programs by reference in part 123 of this chapter. Nothing in this part and parts 123 or 124 of this chapter precludes more stringent state regulation of any activity covered by the regulations. So note that states who decide to administer NPDES programs can make their programs stricter than the federal baseline standards. But why have permits? We have this program, this permitting program, but what exactly are we permitting? Before we talk about how to regulate pollution, we need to know about the types of pollution and types of sources of pollution. Now, there are three types of pollutants discussed here. We have conventional pollutants. This is designated in section 304A4. There is 5-day biochemical oxygen demand, or BOD5. Critters need oxygen to live on. Total suspended solids, TSS. Plants and critters need light and water not filled with particles that choke fish. There's pH. Organisms can't live in too acidic or too basic an environment. Fecal coliform. Bacteria make life uncomfortable. And then there's oil and grease, or O&G. This chokes organisms' ability to breathe, including through their skin. Then we have the primary pollutants. Primary pollutants are also known as toxic pollutants. They're listed in 40 CFR section 40115 and include arsenic, benzene, carbon tetrachloride, copper, lead, mercury, a big issue in South Florida, nickel, silver, toluene, zinc. The entire list can be found at that link, and it is correct. Then we have 5 non-conventional pollutants, those substances which do not fall under the categories of conventional or primary pollutants. Include such parameters as ammonia, nitrogen, phosphorus, chemical oxygen demand, and whole effluent toxicity. Now, asking about primary and non-conventional pollutants are some of my favorite questions on exams, just saying. Now, where do these pollutants come from? Here's where we get into sources. There are different ways to classify the type of pollution source dictated what regulations apply. So we have point sources, non-point sources, direct sources, indirect sources, municipal sources, and non-municipal sources. Now, point source discharges include discharges from publicly owned treatment works, discharges from industrial facilities, and discharges from urban runoff. Some agricultural activities such as concentrated animal feeding operations are required to have NPDES permits. Then we have non-point sources. Non-point sources cover the majority of agricultural facilities and are exempt from NPDES regulations. Another example of non-point source pollution, leaking septic tanks. This has been a real problem in the Indian River Lagoon over about the last decade. Note, this covers Joe Public fertilizing his grass and flower garden. I don't know about you, but I really don't want to have to apply for a permit every time I spike my Satsuma orange trees or fertilize my hibiscus. Then we have direct sources. Direct sources discharge wastewater directly into the receiving body. NPDES permits are issued only to direct point source discharges. Then you have indirect sources. Publicly owned treatment works, industrial and commercial indirect dischargers are not covered by NPDES expressly. The EPA created the National Pretreatment Program as a component of the NPDES permitting program. The National Pretreatment Program requires industrial and commercial dischargers to treat or control pollutants in their wastewater prior to discharge into a POTW. For more information, you can visit the EPA's website there. Then we have municipal sources. Municipal sources are POTWs that receive primarily domestic sewage from residential and commercial customers. Larger POTWs may have wastewater from industrial facilities connected to the POTW sewage system. The treatment provided by POTWs typically includes physical separation and settling, so screening, grit removal, primary settling, biological treatment using trickling filters, activated sludge, and disinfecting. So chlorination using UV and ozone. Then you have non-municipal sources. This includes industrial and commercial facilities and are unique with respect to products and processes present at the facility. Unlike municipal sources, at industrial facilities, raw materials, production processes, treatment technologies utilized, and pollutants discharged vary widely and are dependent on the type of industry and specific facility characteristics. Now that we know about the types of pollutants and the types of sources of pollutants, we can discuss how they are regulated. Now, a permit is typically a license for a facility to discharge a specified amount of a pollutant into a receiving water under certain conditions. However, permits may also authorize facilities to process, incinerate, landfill, or beneficially use sewage sludge. There are two main types of NPDES permits. You have an individual NPDES permit. An individual permit is a permit specifically tailored to an individual facility. Based on the information given by the applying facility, the authority issues the permit to the facility for a specific time period not to exceed 5 years, with a requirement that the facility reapply prior to the expiration date. Then there are general NPDES permits. A general permit covers multiple facilities within a specific category. According to NPDES regulations, general permits may be written to cover categories of point sources having common elements, such as stormwater point sources, facilities that involve the same or substantially similar types of operations, facilities that discharge the same types of wastes or engage in the same types of sludge use or disposal practices, facilities that require the same effluent limits, operating conditions, or standards for sewage sludge use or disposal, and facilities that require the same or similar monitoring. Now, general NPDES permits have some limitations. They may only be issued to discharges within a specific geographical area, so city, county, or state political boundaries, designated planning areas, sewer districts or sewer authorities, a state highway system, standard metropolitan statistical areas, or urbanized areas. There are five major components of a NPDES permit. First is the cover page. Now, don't laugh, I know, but typically, this contains the name and location of the permittee, a statement authorizing the discharge, and the specific locations for which a discharge is authorized. Two is effluent limits, the primary mechanism for controlling discharges of pollutants to receiving waters. Permit writers spend a majority of their time deriving appropriate effluent limits based on applicable technology-based and water quality-based standards. The third section is monitoring and reporting requirements. This is used to characterize waste streams and receiving waters, evaluate wastewater treatment efficiency, and determine compliance with permit conditions. Fourth section is special conditions. These are conditions developed to supplement effluent limit guidelines. Examples include best management practices, additional monitoring activities, ambient stream surveys, and toxicity reduction evaluations. And the last section is the standard conditions. These are pre-established conditions that apply to all NPDES permits and delineate the legal, administrative, and procedural requirements of the permit. So there is steps in developing individual NPDES permits. Step one, derive technology-based effluent limits, or TBLs. Step two, derive effluent limits that are protective of state water quality standards. So this is the water quality-based effluent limits, the WQBLs. So step one looks at the Senate with the technology-based. Step two, you've got the House with their water quality-based. Step three compares the technology-based effluent limits from number one with the water quality-based effluent limits from number two and applies the more stringent limits in the permit. The decision-making process for deriving limits is documented in the permit's fact sheet. It is quite possible that a permit may have limits that are technology-based for some parameters and water quality-based for others. For example, a permit may contain an effluent limitation for TSS based on National Effluent Limit Guidelines, technology-based, a limit for ammonia based on prevention of aquatic toxicity, water quality-based, and a modified limit based for part of the year on effluent limit guidelines, tech-based, and for the remainder of the year on water quality considerations. Step four is develop appropriate monitoring and reporting conditions, facility-specific special conditions, and include standard conditions that are the same for all permits. Congratulations, a permit has been drafted. After the draft is complete, there is public notice announces the permit, and interested parties may submit comments regarding the draft permit. The permitting authority then considers comments and develops the final permit. The final permit is issued for this facility. Note the CYA provision here. If Susie Citizen decides to challenge a permit in court, she has the administrative record to refer to, but the agency also has the administrative record to refer to show that they went through all the required steps and followed all the regulations. Now, developing general NPDES permits. The process for general NPDES permits is similar to the process for individual NPDES permits. However, there are differences in the order of events. First, identify the need for a general permit by collecting data demonstrating that a group or category of dischargers has similarities that warrant a general permit. In deciding whether to develop a general permit, permitting authorities consider the following. Are there a large number of facilities to be covered? Do the facilities have similar production processes or activities? Do the facilities generate similar pollutants? Do only a small percentage of the facilities have the potential for violations of water quality standards? Facilities that wish to be covered under the general permit generally submit a notice of intent to the permitting authority after the general permit has been issued. Translation: a general or blanket permit for something is issued, then the individual facilities apply to get covered under this general permit in place of having an individual permit. The permitting authority may then either request additional information, called an RAI, describing the facility, notify the facility that it is covered by the general permit, or require the facility to apply for an individual permit. Now, there is this third thing called watershed permitting, and this shows the general EPA goal of integrating the NPDES program further into the concept of watershed planning. It's to examine the core functions of the NPDES program, how to adapt NPDES to promote community-based water resource management. This may be better than permitting on source-by-source basis. Watershed permits set ambient water quality requirements that must be met using a combination of point and non-point source controls, and controls selected through a local watershed planning process. Permits may contain individual point source effluent limits that meet technology-based requirements, and certain water quality-based requirements not addressed in the watershed plans. Now, There have been a number of case studies where the EPA has done watershed permits over the last 20 or so years, but they are not the most commonly used types of permits. For more information on watershed permitting, and if you are interested to review any of the different case studies, I point you in the direction of the EPA's watershed-based permitting page. But remember, if I ask you what are the types of permits that NPDES has, it's individual and general on the exam. Given all this, who has the authority to issue permits? The EPA authorized to directly implement the NPDES program. The EPA may authorize states, territories, or tribes to implement all or parts of the national program. States, territories, or tribes applying for authorization may seek the authority to implement the base program, i.e. issue individual NPDES permits for industrial and municipal sources, and additional parts of the national program, including permitting of federal facilities, administering the national pretreatment program, and or administering the municipal sewage sludge program. If the state, territory, or tribe has only partial authority, e.g. only the base NPDES permits program, EPA will implement the other program activities. For example, a state may have an approved NPDES program but has not received EPA approval of the state's municipal sewage sludge program. The EPA region would be responsible for ensuring conditions be implemented the standards for the use or disposal of sewage sludge, 40 CFR Section 503, were included in NPDES permits issued to PODWs in that state. EPA may issue a separate NPDES permit with the applicable sewage sludge standards and requirements, or may negotiate with the state on joint issuance of NPDES permits. The same process also applies where a state, territory, or tribe has not received approval for administering the National Pre-Treatment Program or permitting of federal facilities. In general, once a state, territory, or tribe is authorized to issue permits or administer a part of the program, EPA no longer conducts these activities. However, EPA must have an opportunity to review each permit issued by the state, territory, or tribe. EPA may formally object to elements that conflict with federal requirements, and if the permitting agency does not address the objection points, EPA will issue a permit themselves. So what about Florida? Florida has established its own NPDES program and has to get EPA's okay before issuing a NPDES permit. This is in Florida Statute Section 403.0885. The legislature finds and declares that it is in the public interest to promote effective and efficient regulation of the discharge of pollutants into waters of the state and eliminate duplication of permitting programs by the United States Environmental Protection Agency under Section 402 of the Clean Water Act and the department under this chapter. It is further found that the state implementation of federal NPDES program with sufficient time for legislative revision prior to the implementation of the state NPDES permit program by the department would promote the orderly establishment of a state-administered NPDES program. It is the specific intent of the legislature that permit fees charged by the department for processing of federally approved NPDES permits be adequate to cover the entire cost of the Department of Program Management for reviewing and acting upon any permit application, and to cover the cost of surveillance and other field services of any permits issued pursuant to this section. So the Florida legislature took the initiative to establish a state NPDES program in accordance with Section 402, but with the proviso that the state program be self-supporting. The Florida Department of Environmental Protection has a website on the Florida NPDES program that is given there. Now, Florida NPDES timing, and this is Florida Statute Section 403.0885, an application for a NPDES permit or other approvals from the state relating to the permitted activity shall be granted or denied by the department within the time allowed for permit review under 40 CFR 124A. I'm going to stop so you can read the rest of this. And we're back. And the translation here is time windows exist for permit application review. Note that it specifically refers to EPA regulations. It also gives applicants a way to push DEP to render a decision by allowing the applicant to file suit in state court to force DEP to say yay or nay on an application. Now, does the federal government in the state of Florida play nice? Not always. Starting in 2009, the EPA determined that Florida waters were highly impaired in regards to recreational uses and aquatic life. The EPA began meeting with the Florida Department of Environmental Protection to put in place specific numeric nutrient criteria in Florida state law. The nutrients in question are phosphorus and nitrogen. The meetings between the EPA and FDP were the result of a settlement between the EPA and the Florida Wildlife Federal lawsuit. This settlement is contained within a consent decree. Through lots of workshops, public meetings, two public reviews, the EPA proposed two nutrient limits. One was developed for inland waters and one for coastal waters. The final standard set numeric limits or criteria on the amount of nutrient pollution allowed in Florida's lakes, rivers, streams, and springs. This final action seeks to improve water quality, protect public health, aquatic life, and the long-term recreational uses of Florida's waters, which are a critical part of the state's economy. The EPA has published the inland and coastal rules. You can read both rules at this archive website. Fast forward 5 years later. In March 2013, US EPA and FDEP reached an agreement on nutrient standards. Florida Department of Environmental Protection and the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency have reached an agreement to protect Florida's waterways from excess nitrogen and phosphorus pollution. These pollutants cause algal blooms and are among the largest contributors to water quality problems in Florida. This agreement marks a significant step forward in protecting and restoring water quality across the state. A number of milestones were subsequently established and implemented. And you can see those resources at the websites there. You don't like a permit? Take them to court. We can indeed sue to enforce the law. Usually, you can't force a government official to enforce a law unless the official is strictly mandated to perform something specific as part of his job, or the law itself gives Joe Public permission to sue to have the law enforced. When an official is strictly mandated to perform some action as part of his job, then a person who has been injured by such official not performing such action can bring a lawsuit for a writ of mandamus. A writ of mandamus is a court order from a superior court commanding an inferior tribunal, board, corporation, or person to perform a purely ministerial duty imposed by law. Now, most environmental laws contain citizen suit provisions, which allow for Susie Citizen to sue not only a polluter who is breaking the law, but also the government official who is supposed to administer the law. You cannot use a writ of mandamus in an environmental case because the administering agency's duty is not ministerial in nature. The law doesn't say shall. Section 505 says that a citizen may bring a lawsuit under the CWA, but only on his own behalf. Who can a citizen sue? A polluter violating the CWA, or the EPA administrator for not enforcing the law or not performing his duty under the CWA, so long as his duty is not discretionary. So this is 33 U.S.C. Section 1365 for the full text, and I give you that at the GPO's U.S. Code website. Please note that an action can only be commenced on an individual citizen's behalf. As reviewed in our first lecture, an environmental group cannot bring suit on behalf of the general public. The group must be backing a specific individual who has been injured. I want to also point out that if a citizen sues the EPA administrator, the allegation must be that the administrator did not perform an act or duty that the administrator must perform. There can be no discretion on the part of the administrator. For instance, a power plant applies for a variance permit and the administrator grants it. Susie Citizen lives just downstream from the power plant, and the extra pollutants will kill off her favorite fish that she fishes for in the river in her backyard. Susie Citizen cannot sue the administrator, saying that it was the administrator's duty to deny the permit. The administrator has discretion on whether to grant a variance permit or not. Let's change the situation a little. Before issuing the permit, the administrator must publish the proposed permit in the Federal Register and receive comments for 60 days. The administrator did not publish the proposed permit. Susie Citizen can sue to postpone the issuance of the permit and require the administrator to publish the proposed permit and receive comments on it. Since the publication requirement is purely ministerial in function, then the court would issue a writ of mandamus. Well, there are timing issues. When can Susie Citizen sue? Susie Citizen has to give notice to the EPA administrator, the state where the CWA violation occurred, and the polluter. Then Susie Citizen has to wait 60 days for a reply before filing anything with the court. This subsection establishes a hoop. You have to give notice not only to the EPA administrator, but also the state involved and to the violator also. If you don't meet this requirement, the court will pitch your case and you have to start from square one and wait another 60 days, thereby allowing 60 days more pollution dumping. But if the EPA or the state has already dragged the polluter into court, then Susie Citizen cannot file a personal lawsuit, but is allowed to join the government's lawsuit. Can anyone think of a reason why a person might want to do this if the feds or the state are already taking care of the problem? Also, any notice sent to the administrator has to be in the form designated by the administrator by regulation. What kind of notification is required? Here is where you look to 40 CFR section 135.3, notice of suit. In giving notice of a lawsuit against a polluter, the notice must be specific and include what standard, limitation, or order was violated by the polluter, what activity resulted in the violation, who is responsible for the violation, i.e. the name of the owner or operator of the source, the location of the violation, the dates of the violation, the full name, address, and telephone number of the citizen sending the notice. Now, in subsection B here, in giving notice of a lawsuit against the administrator, the notice must include how the administrator failed to act or carry out a mandatory duty under the CWA. Need to be very specific about which section of the CWA created the required action or created the duty. What activities did the administrator do or did not do that constitutes the violation? And the full name, address, and telephone number of the citizen sending the notice. Now, under Section C, in any notice, whether about a polluter or the administrator, if the citizen is represented by a lawyer, then the notice must contain the name, address, and telephone number of the lawyer. This may seem like a duh comment, but notice that if Susie Citizen wants to bring notice of a violation to a polluter or the administrator, she has to state her name, address, and phone number in the notice. There is no such thing as an anonymous tip. Part 135, subpart A, contains two different service sections. Service in this part means service of process. Service of process is giving a party to a lawsuit, i.e. defendant, the paperwork involved in the lawsuit. So plaintiff decides to sue defendant. Plaintiff must file a complaint with the court, but the plaintiff must serve or give a copy of the complaint to the defendant so the defendant knows he or she is being sued. The law states specifically how the plaintiff must deliver or serve the complaint to the defendant. In Part 135, Subpart A, there is service of notice, meaning Susie Citizen has to follow certain steps to notify the administrator and the polluter that she is going to file a lawsuit. And then there is service of complaint, which are the steps Susie Citizen has to take to file the actual lawsuit complaint with the court and send copies to the administrator and the polluter. Anyone confused? This is why you hire a lawyer. So Citizen Suit, Section 505C. When Susie Citizens files suit, there are a few things to keep in mind. Can only sue in the court where the violation occurred, i.e. where the end of the pipe is basically located. So, if a pollution source is located just over the county line in Martin County, and most of the pollution impacts residents in Jupiter and Tequesta, those residents cannot sue the polluter in Palm Beach County because the polluter is physically located in Martin County. Even if you don't put the EPA administrator's name on the paperwork you file with the court, the administrator can intervene as a matter of right, i.e., the CWA says the administrator can join the lawsuit if he wants to. In any lawsuit Susie Citizen files with the CWA, a copy of any paperwork filed must be sent to the U.S. Attorney General. Why? This is to make sure that any court order which might change a variance permit or order a polluter to follow the established effluent limitations, etc., may require the EPA to do more frequent or stricter monitoring of the polluter and take up more resources than EPA had established for that particular polluter. You've got to let the government lawyer know when you're suing the government or suing that may impact the government. So attorney's fees, Section 505D. The court in issuing any final order in any action brought pursuant to this section may award costs of limitation, including reasonable attorney and expert witness fees, to any prevailing or substantially prevailing party whenever the court determines such award is appropriate. The court may, if a temporary restraining order or preliminary injunction is sought, require the filing of a bond or equivalent security in accordance with the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. This is where it becomes worthwhile for Susie Citizen to sue. Environmental lawsuits require specialized lawyers and expert witnesses familiar with specific pollutants and their effects, both of this which require extensive time commitments. These lawsuits tend to drag on for years before some resolution is reached. Well, what about mootness? Just for your information, an action is considered moot when it no longer presents a justiciable controversy because issues involved have become academic or dead. Huh? Something has happened where a court verdict will no longer solve the problem, and to continue the case just to answer the original question becomes a matter of semantics. In general, if a case becomes moot, a court will dismiss it. This is especially true at the Supreme Court level. Now, having said that, there are very rare cases where the Supreme Court will note the mootness of a case, but issue a decision to head off problems in the future. When I say rare, I mean there is only one case I can think of off the top of my head that qualifies as a decision issued by the Supremes despite the case being moot. It is still a huge issue today. Care to hazard a guess? It is Roe v. Wade. Pregnancy takes only 9 months, but a lawsuit takes years. If I ran a search for decisions issued despite the underlying facts mooting the need for a decision, I can tell you there are maybe a handful. I mention this decision only as an example. I am not commenting on the decision or it being overturned recently in any way. What if a lawsuit is brought, the polluter fights it in court, but in practice, changes how they dump the pollutant so that the pollution is no longer occurring? Does this make the original lawsuit moot because the polluter is no longer polluting? In one sense, yes, the suit is moot. In another, no, because it took a lawsuit to make the polluter change his or her actions, and the plaintiff, i.e. Susie Citizen, can point towards the polluter's actions and say, hey, they changed their practices because we sued them. In this type of case, it would be likely that the court would award attorney's fees to Susie Citizen because the polluter changed his or her behavior. Section 505 G and H. For the purpose of this section, the term citizen means a person or persons having an interest, which is or may be adversely affected. So this definition expands on the general legal principle of injury we discussed first class. A plaintiff usually has to show actual injury, or injury in fact, in order to get through the courthouse door to sue. This section allows for more leeway. The words maybe points to a potential or future harm. So polluter starts polluting and Susie Citizen sues because if the pollutant accumulates, it will kill the fish in her stream. But the fish haven't died yet. Subsection H, a governor of a state may commence a civil suit under subsection A without regard to the limitations of subsection B of this action against the administrator where there is alleged a failure of the administrator to enforce an effluent standard or limitation under this act, the violation of which is occurring in another state and is causing an adverse effect on the public health or welfare of his state, or is causing a violation of any water quality requirement in his state. So subsection H allows a governor to sue the EPA administrator without having to wait 60 days or give notice to the polluter in question. This is useful where the state does not administer the Clean Water Act and leaves it up to the EPA. If the EPA isn't following the law or its own regulations, then the state has a shortcut route into court. Florida law doesn't have a citizen suit provision, but the federal law covers the state law enactment. Florida law does have specific enforcement procedures. Section 403.121 establishes both judicial and administrative remedies. Judicial remedies. The department may institute a civil action in a court of competent jurisdiction to establish liability and to recover damages for any injury to air, waters, or property, including animal, plant, and aquatic life, of the state caused by any violation. B, the department may institute a civil action in a court of competent jurisdiction to impose and recover a civil penalty for each violation in the amount of not more than $10,000 per offense. However, the court may receive evidence in mitigation. Each day during any portion of which such violation occurs constitutes a separate offense. C, except as provided in paragraph 2C, it shall not be a defense to or ground for dismissal of these judicial remedies for damages and civil penalties that the defendant has failed to exhaust its administrative remedies, but has failed to serve a notice of violation or has failed to hold an administrative hearing prior to the institution of a civil action. So Florida law limits how much the state can recover per offense. But then the law continues to explain that each day, even if it's only for 5 minutes, that a source violates the law, it is a new and separate offense. If a source pollutes for 50 days, that is $500,000, possibly. I say possibly because the court can view evidence from the polluter that something broke and they've been trying to fix it in order to come back into compliance with the law. This may not seem like a big deal, but in reality, it is. Subparagraph C also provides the DEP with the ability to go straight to court without having to exhaust potential administrative remedies. Section 404 permits. Now, in addition to being able to dump chemicals into waters of the United States, there's another dumping permit under the Clean Water Act in Section 404. A Section 404 permit is a dredge and fill permit. In order for a city or state to dredge a channel to clear out silt to reopen a channel into a port, it is necessary to get a permit to dig up that silt to allow for orderly progression of seafaring traffic. The EPA states activities in waters of the United States regulated under the program, Section 404 dredge and fill permits, include fill for development, water resource projects such as dams and levees, infrastructure development such as highways and airports, and mining projects. Now here is the odd part about Section 404 permits. It is run by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Why, you ask? Because the Army Corps of Engineers was tasked with keeping U.S. ports clear for seafaring vessels used in interstate commerce under the Rivers and Harbors Act of 1899. Section 10 of the Rivers and Harbors Act of 1899 states that the creation of any obstruction not affirmatively authorized by Congress to the navigable capacity of any waters of the United States is hereby prohibited, and it shall not be lawful to build or commence the building of any wharf, pier, dolphin, boom, weir, breakwater, bulkhead, jetty, or other structures in any port, roadstead, haven, harbor, canal, navigable river, or other water of the United States, outside established harbor lines, or where no harbor lines have been established, except on plans recommended by the chief engineers and authorized by the Secretary of War. And it shall not be lawful to excavate or fill, or in any manner to alter or modify the course, location, condition, or capacity of any port, roadstead, haven, harbor, canal, lake, harbor, or refuge, or enclosure within the limits of any breakwater, or of the channel of any navigable water of the United States, unless the work has been recommended by the chief engineer and authorized by the Secretary of War prior to the beginning of the same. So, since the Army Corps of Engineers had authority of dredge and fill, Congress kept that authority with the Corps and gave the EPA the authority to determine where disposal sites may be sited and can close disposal sites as well. The EPA administrator has the authority to deny a permit. Additionally, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the National Marine Fisheries Service have the responsibility to evaluate impacts on fish and wildlife of all new federal projects and federally permitted projects, including projects subject to the requirements of Section 404, pursuant to the Fish and Wildlife Coordination Act, and elevate specific cases or policy issues pursuant to Section 404Q. Can states administer Section 404 permitting programs? The answer to this question is yes and no. Yes, states can assume Section 404 permit, but here's the no part. The Corps does not have to give full authority to the state for all waters within the state borders. The Corps retains control of all waters that fall on federal lands. A clear example of this is Eglin Air Force Base in Okaloosa County in the Florida Panhandle. Eglin AFB has a port to allow for U.S. Navy vessels to bring in air wings for joint exercises. In order to keep the port deep enough for naval vessel displacement, it is necessary to dredge every once in a while. Since this is a federal government installation, a federal agency, i.e. the Army Corps of Engineers, needs to issue the permit for dredging as opposed to a state agency. If you are interested in a more in-depth review of the law and how Florida can assume the Section 404 permitting authority, the Florida Bar Journal published an article by Adam F. Blaylock in the September-October 2018 issue. So the latest news on clean water. Navigable waters. As you have been reading about our laws, a lot of the application has to do with the definitions of words. Almost all laws have definition sections, so people who are covered by the law or judges will not have to guess what the legislature meant when it used a specific word. A term in the Clean Water Act that has had much discussion in litigation is what is meant by navigable waters. Does this mean that only waters deep enough and wide enough to float a cargo ship on? Does it include rivers and streams that you can canoe or rowboat on? Does it include smaller rivers and streams that feed into larger rivers that allow for floating boats? Does it include wetlands along the sides of rivers or those that drain into rivers? In 2015, the Obama administration updated the definition of waters of the United States. This rule makes the process of identifying waters protected under the CWA easier to understand, more predictable, and consistent with the law and peer-reviewed science while protecting the streams and wetlands that form the foundations of our nation's water resources. 80 Federal Register 37053. The Trump administration changed the rule in October 2019 back to what it was before the 2015 change. In April 2020, the U.S. Supreme Court in County of Maui versus Hawaii Wildlife Fund ruled that the Clean Water Act applies to some pollutants that reach the sea and other protected waters indirectly through groundwater. The dispute concerned a wastewater treatment plant on Maui, Hawaii, that used injection wells to dispose of some 4 million gallons of treated sewage each day by pumping it into groundwater about a half a mile from the Pacific Ocean. Some of the waste reached the ocean. The Trump administration filed a brief supporting Maui County, which operates the treatment plant, saying that the law does not apply to discharges that travel through groundwater before reaching protected waters. In a 6-3 ruling, the court rejected what it called the extreme position advanced by the parties and the administration, returning the case to an appeals court for reconsideration under a new standard. But the decision was on balance a victory for environmental groups, as it allowed at least some lawsuits over groundwater discharges. On June 22, 2020, the Navigable Waters Protection Rule became effective. Then, the presidential administration changed. On June 9, 2021, the EPA and the Department of Army announced they were reviewing the rule defining waters of the United States, or WOTUS. The proposed rule was published in the Federal Register in December 2021, with the comment period open until February 7, 2022. And in October 2022, the Supreme Court heard another WOTUS case, Sackett versus EPA. A preview of the case was written up by the Congressional Research Service. This case has not been resolved, but we will likely hear the final ruling before the end of the spring class. Our next class, we will discuss wetlands. See you on the discussion boards.